Oh, this interview. So, you're ready?
Gotcha.
Yeah. Welcome, Nickelback, to Pirate Rock Nickelback Special, because this is what this is going to be about.
Okay.
And welcome to Stockholm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us. Thanks for coming and taking the time.
Yeah, well, no problem. You know it. I heard you came from, was it Amsterdam?
Yeah.
And, you know, I heard some gossip. You live to tell this story about the Amsterdam you live.
Oh, yeah.
Crazy town, huh?
We're used to Amsterdam. We can get through without getting beat up too much. So.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't get too close to dying anymore. For the first couple of visits, we're a little bit mixed.
Already died a couple of times and come back.
Exactly.
Maybe.
It's interesting when you're doing a TV show, and they're basing the TV show around the premise that they're going to win the soccer match. And there's thousands of people outside. And when they don't win and things don't go well, they're like, all right, boys, well, we got Nickelback here. Sit away. And we're like, they're going to make you feel better.
We're looking at each other like, really? Are you fucking kidding me?
And we're like, Never made it as a wise man.
We remind you of what you nearly had.
Yeah.
You almost had it.
It's like, and we're going to go now. Yeah, it's interesting.
Sports.
For sure.
Sports, always a heartbreak.
Well,
for someone.
It's good that you're in ice hockey country then.
Yeah, absolutely.
And sorry.
Yeah, we don't want
to talk about it.
I don't want to talk about it.
Congratulations.
I knew you were headed.
Congratulations.
We're actually here to take the medals home.
Yes. Well, we're here to talk about the record, of course.
Yes.
We're going to get to that. Yeah, no problem. And, but you're from Hanaberta and Brooks, right? Alberta, Canada.
Yeah.
Tell me something about your hometown. Where are you from?
It's a town of about 2,900 people, Hannah, and there's nothing to do there except go to the bar, play hockey, or learn how to play an instrument.
Yeah,
you know, and that's about it. So,
yeah, it's like a farm town.
And none of us are very good hockey players.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Not good enough, that's for sure.
We struggle.
You can tell what we did.
So it was the music mostly.
Yep.
In hometown?
For us. Yeah. For us it was.
If you know, in Sweden we have music classes and we have like you can rehearse in studios and stuff that how do you have accessibility for that?
So I know a bunch of
No, the answer to that one is first no.
So I know. So you know, remember Ricard and Peter who work with Max Martin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They told me all about
the Swedish
in,
way.
In Sweden, like music's a big deal. So in school, they learn.
I've heard of a few Swedish artists.
Yeah.
Very popular.
Yeah.
I can see why.
So they focus on it a lot. Yeah. We didn't have the education system you have for music. Like everybody here can play an instrument, it seems like. And that's like we're from, you can't get your passport unless you can skate. And, I wish that we had the, sort of the academic push for music the way that the Swedish people do.
That being said, it was pretty organic how it worked out in Hanna. I was in Brooksville, I was 13, then I moved to Hanna, met these guys. Yeah. So my teen years when we were playing music actually was in Hanna. But there was this one lady in town, Roxy.
Roxy, yeah, I was thinking.
And
that.
Yeah. The drummer that I was playing with knew her and the family. I think she was a single mom with a couple of girls in school. And she let us use half of her garage in the back. She parked on the one side, so she only had the one car. She only needed it. And then we used the other half to jam in. So I played in a group. These guys came. We played another group. We all kind of jammed there. And it was a place for everybody to hang out after school till 2 in the morning. She didn't care. The neighbors didn't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still kind of, I think about that to this day where I don't know why she did that.
It's a bit confusing.
It was
really great though.
Big, big outlet
for
people wanting to play music. Cause then you'd play, friends would come in, listen to you, you'd have kind of an audience. And it was a real creative kind of place for an outlet for playing music. So, you know, very appreciative of
it was
her
a real,
letting us
it was
do that.
A really important gift because, her kids didn't play music with us at all.
No.
She just let us use her space know, to bring friends and do whatever we wanted to do.
See, I have an entirely different memory of all of this.
Do you?
Because I was younger.
Yeah.
These guys, I'm 2 years younger than these guys. So if anytime I was even allowed in to the garage to watch, the only way I was allowed to play is if one of them got up to go to the bathroom.
And
you have to know how to play every instrument.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you can't go and sit in for a second and play. And because if you can't go and play for a second, or, you know, the singer goes outside for a smoke, then you grab the microphone and you sing one. And if you suck, you pretty much, they don't want you coming back. So
that's usually the case.
Yeah, generally speaking, in one way or another. Yeah.
But please don't sing again.
Yeah. So it was a little different. Mine was more like trial by fire.
Yeah.
Where, you know, I didn't have a key to the garage. I couldn't go there whenever I wanted to. I mean, these guys got to. Half the time I was knocking on the door, seeing if I could even just get in.
That's how we make musical Spartans.
Yep.
There, you know.
Yep.
It's like Eurovision.
So my memories are entirely different than their memories of Roxy's garage.
Well, it's the same place. You were just on a different side of the walls.
Yep. This is very true.
Well, is that, would you say that Nickelback started at that garage, or was it somewhere else? Where did it start at?
I think musically we all kind of had our outlets. He played in another band, another city later on. And we all kind of just played around town. So we
could have been kind of a beginning, but it wasn't the formal beginning.
Yeah, like musically, we definitely all started playing music when we were in Hannah.
Yeah.
But Nickelback didn't start until Chad, it was in summer of 95, where he said he had some songs we should go try to record it, because we knew somebody that had a connection to a studio in Vancouver. And we're like, yeah, you know what? Let's just go see what it's like to be in the studio. And he had all this material he wanted to. He'd been writing a bunch and writing good songs back then. And so we went, recorded it in a day and a half, came back, and we're like, all right, that was great. That's it. And when we didn't make a band name. Like, we weren't thinking about making a band. It was just about, let's just record some songs.
Cool.
And here we are.
Speaking of the band name, I have to ask, where does the name come from?
That's amazing. This question keeps coming up.
Yeah, people are interested.
20 years. No, it's cool. It's cool. It's great. It's just I'm amazed that it's still news. I was working in a coffee shop in Vancouver, and I had to give people 5 cents change back all the time, and it was, here's your nickel back. And it just I remember one morning really early, stopping the lineup early in the morning of people just waiting to have their first morning coffee. And I remember stopping the lineup and getting on the phone. I forget who I called. And I was like, hey, what do you think of the band name Nickelback? And he's like, oh, I don't know. You know,
what does it mean?
The morning. And I was just like, well, it doesn't really mean anything. It just kind of sounds interesting.
Yeah.
And I remember a lineup of angry people looking at me going, you know, I don't care about your fucking band. And I just want to get my coffee so I can wake up and go to work, you know. But
it's still that way.
Yeah, it is still that way.
It's a great promo from the beginning. Nickelback.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
The band was formed. Let's jump to that, right? Describe for me the first couple of years with Nickelback. How was it, like, setbacks or all success from the beginning?
No, I don't ever remember any setbacks. I always remember there being one more gig coming up. There's always, oh, we got to practice for this gig. It was always one more thing. We got a little mini tour opening up for this bigger band. It was always something coming, you know, and then it was always it's time to try and make another record. And so we would try and fund another album. We just, and that got kind of scary, you know, because we started, you know, just acquiring such a massive debt that the next thing you know, I owed $4,000 to my stepdad. We owed $5,000 to our grandmother.
My mom.
We owed $5,000 to Margaret. Margaret as well.
Yeah. We owed money all over town.
We had
to put up the money for the distribution.
Oh, and then we also had We also owed like $25,000 to the bank. But by the time it was said and done, when they went to give us a record deal, Roadrunner's first offer was like $80,000 or $90,000. I'm like, what are we gonna do with that? I'm like, that's just enough to pay the bill. That's how much we owe. Yeah. You know what I'm like? And then you want us to go on the road for a year?
I'm we were like it was like any other small business. You know, yeah. you invest for many years in the beginnings. You know, you don't make any money.
I think correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah, I think every band goes through the same thing, and there's always this one guy who like. Always ahead of everyone else. Who was that guy in Nickelback? You know, like making the calls, trying to book gigs and stuff like that.
We're kind of all doing it.
Yeah.
It was spread across the board. He was the guy on making the calls on the phone to the radio stations saying, "Hey, this is do you say Chad from the Nickelback camp,
or did
you say somebody other name?"
No, I said Chad
from the Nickelback camp.
Yeah.
So he didn't think it was in the band. It was like just somebody from this big, massive.
Yeah,
corporation right. Pushing Nickelback.
Representing the band.
I worked with the booking agent, make sure the shows were online.
Yeah.
And at that point, websites had just started up, so we were doing the internet stuff. And when he would get radio play in certain cities, he would follow up with those cities to make sure the record was in those stores.
Yeah.
So that and it was just knocking them down as you went along. So.
Do you think is it important, you think it's the whole package, you know, it's not only the music, you need to have like everything organized. Is that as much as important?
When you're doing it independently, you don't have a choice.
Yeah,
you have to wear a different hat. Yeah. You know, you have to wear several different hats. So, you know, sometimes you're the singer, or sometimes you're the bass player, and then sometimes you're the you know, you run distribution, and sometimes you run radio, and sometimes you're on the phone with, you know, managers that are trying to rip you off.
Yeah.
You know, it's that's a great way to learn. We never got ripped off horribly.
No.
I mean, we might have lost a couple $1,000 here and a couple $1,000 there, and it wasn't that bad.
When it's all you got, it seems like a lot.
Yeah,
but back in the day, the great lessons. Much. But I always find that funny where some people, you know, when
those are very cheap life, very cheap life lessons.
Cheap lessons. But when they say, you know, oh, I just focus on the art. I like to focus on the art. Well, that's fantastic. Okay, because we like it too. I mean, that's why you start it.
Yeah.
But if you allow yourself to not be aware of everything else, you're gonna get ripped off so easily. It's like you can make, I just make this art, and all of a sudden, you know, if you just go too far that direction, someone goes, well, you owe this much money, and they cut you off at the knees, and you're like, well, the art's not going to last too long if you get taken advantage of. So I think we knew that early on, that we had to learn about this other side of it.
Yeah.
And,
the dark side.
The dark side of it.
Very dark side.
So how do we handle that dark side? We hired a lawyer. and he's been guiding us for a long time.
It went even darker.
Exactly.
He delves in the dark side quite well.
Yeah, he rolls in the mud.
Well, you guys started off awesome with two great records, but you know, when Silver Side Up came, you know, it was kind of the break for you guys.
Yeah.
How did your life change after that?
I think.
That's a good question, man. Thinking about that right now.
It happened while we were on the road.
Yeah.
So we were on the road for 14 months touring the state because we got signed with the state album to Roadrunner Records. And so then we stopped. We took 5 weeks off. We made Silver Side Up.
Yeah.
And then the record company was like, okay, this How You Remind Me song is really good.
Yeah.
This has got something to it. We need to really push this. And we were all just kind of like, oh, good. We were like, yeah, glad you like it.
Yeah.
Mike wanted Never Again to be the first single.
Yeah.
He didn't even want to go with How You Remind Me first.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the record company was like, no. Trust us on this one. We've just worked you guys for 14 months. Trust us. How You Remind Me is the best shot you guys have.
Yeah, and
we need to go with this.
And like us, I remember this part too. Like us, at that point, Roadrunner Records wasn't in for $100,000. They were in for over $1 million. and they hadn't made anything yet either. Yeah. So it was like,
which isn't a lot for a label.
We should listen to these guys a little bit, because they've only been spending on us at this point and not made a dime. So let's go. If they were willing to sort of reinvest for another album, it was a miracle.
Yeah. Well, they really wanted a band that they could break on the radio. And they put all the chips on us. Mm. And for an independent label, I mean, so Case Wessels from Holland, he spent $1.7 million out of his own pocket trying to break a band from Vancouver. And, you know, it felt nice to go and record a song like How You Remind Me and, you know, see him. You know, see him get that payoff.
Yeah.
You know?
Pay back the old man.
Pay back the old man.
Yeah.
exactly. And so when it happened, so we were on the road, because we took 5 weeks off and we were straight back on the road. And that's one thing about, like, Roadrunner, they didn't know how to break a band any other way. It's like, oh, yeah. Metal, you tour. That's all you do, is you just go on the road and you never, ever, ever come off the road, and you just tour nonstop.
And there's something good about that. That's a great policy to have.
Yeah.
You know, they were really, really strong on getting artists out there to play.
Do you think that it's a... because of internet and stuff like that, you know, you can get to the music so easy nowadays. You know, before I always went to the record store, but nowadays you just pick up your phone and put on the music you want. Is touring more important today?
I think it was more important back then.
You know what?
Like now, you couldn't get known through the internet back then.
Yeah, it's changed completely.
But now, if someone, I mean, there's just so much. If someone sees you and they're entertained by what you do, I think that if you can prove yourself on a stage and make a fan, you know, make a stranger a fan from playing your music live to them, I think that says more, because you're right. Mm-hmm. There's just so much stuff there. I mean, there's just Spotify, there's Apple, everything, and it's all just so easy to get to.
Yeah.
It is so hard to break through. I would not want to be a band trying to break in 2017, no fucking way. I wouldn't even know where to start.
Hard. Well, first you make a viral video. You make deliberately a viral video.
Yeah.
What I hear on the internets these days.
You know, when you started touring...
That was a joke.
Yeah, I know.
Right, okay, good. Right.
Did you ever feel like you were losing control when everything was happening so fast?
No, because... You know, everything that we'd learned...
We didn't know we had control.
Yeah,
yeah, we never felt like we ever had... I don't know if we have any now.
Once we made Silver Side Up, we wanted more control.
Yeah.
So then we told the label, okay, we made a record and we let Rick Parasher, we let him produce it. But we wanted to produce that one ourselves. And they're like, no. You're not going to produce, because they just thought that we didn't know what we were doing.
Yeah.
So then after that, we were like, okay, we want to produce. We want to be in the driver's seat. We want to make all the calls. I mean, so they were so unaware that we were aware of what was going on with everything, because normally what happens is, okay, you get a recording advance and all that money sits at the label.
Yeah.
And any bill that comes in for your record, they just pay it. It's like, okay, we'll just pay it. So our producer comes into town and he wants to stay at a really nice hotel, and we're like, no. And he wants a car allowance every day, and he wants a per diem every day, and all these things. We're like, no. You can stay at that hotel. If you want to eat something beyond whatever it is, you can pay for it yourself, because we gave him, $25,000 or $29,000 or something?
I don't remember. It was much less than he wanted, but it was a bit of a street fight, literally. I remember, I was telling the guys, I remember the night I was literally in the street arguing with Rick about
Because he
was used to...
He's just used to...
Pearl Jam. To, he did Pearl Jam. He did like Temple of the Dog. He did Alice in Chains. He did all these...
He was used to people not paying attention. Right? Yeah. He was used to the record company just going, oh yeah, $1,000 a day for a hotel, no problem. Oh, you want champagne and lobster? No problem. And then they would just pass the bill to the artist, but the artist didn't know until it was too late. But we were standing there going, okay, I'm in the street and I'm wearing my... like my clothes from working in a lumber yard, driving a forklift and stacking fucking bricks and boards, going, dude, you know, I just got off my second job today.
Yeah.
And you're telling, no. I was like, I have to work for, you know, 3 weeks to make enough to pay for your hotel. No.
Yeah, because he didn't like it. When you don't spend that money, whatever you don't spend is yours.
Yeah.
You get to put it in your pocket. So when a band goes in and makes a record, and then they come out and they're like, so now what do we do? Well, if I was the manager, I would say, well, I guess you go back on the road and you try and make some money. Getting paid $1,000 opening up for somebody else.
Or less.
Or less. And like, you know, so we knew right away, if we don't spend the money in the studio, we get to keep it. And the more money we could put in our pockets, we knew... the longer we could go out on the road and we could still have our homes, you know, back in like any place where we were renting or whatever it might be, you know, girlfriends would have a place to stay. We'd still have a car waiting for you when you got home.
Yeah.
Car that works.
A car that works. Yeah. Car that works.
That was much later when we got cars that worked.
Less wood, more metal. And it was, they had no idea. We were like, No, we're going to administer our own funds for the record. And they were just like, no. We control the spending of that. Like, no, you don't. Because you were just going to okay a $1,000 hotel bill for our producer.
Yeah.
And you were going to okay, all you're going to sit there and just pay everything. And we're not okay with that. That's our money, not your money. And then they were just like, okay, hold on a second. We got to get on the phone with business affairs. And we have to speak to our lawyer because we're not used to this. We're not used to a band controlling all the money. And you're like,
we got a code red here.
We got a bit of code red here.
We got a code red.
We got a band that knows what they're doing here. We're not used to this at all. What do we do here? Now, is there a book we're supposed to look at?
One thing, like having said all this, I don't want to say that Rick wasn't worth.
Rick was great.
He was worth. Way more than what we paid him.
Yeah,
but true. Only because we couldn't afford to pay him what he was worth. Mm-hmm. Because we didn't have anything at all. You know, so I don't, you know, I want anybody to feel like we felt like we were getting ripped off by Rick, because it was a great experience. We got a great record out of working with Rick, and he was worth far more than what we paid.
Very true.
And I have to say too, as much as when we finally came to an understanding with the label, I have to say, I think Roadrunner Records was like the best relationship we had with a label. You hear these horror stories, and you get through the battles that you have to get through, but in general, they fought hard for our album, and we really appreciate the label.
The ongoing joke was, where do you find these employees? Where do you find them? These people that worked for Roadrunner Records would kill or die to get your songs played on the radio, to get you good interviews. I mean, they just wouldn't quit.
They loved the label.
They were street fighters, for sure.
And it was amazing. Like, we've been on, you know, so Roadrunner would then at one point in time, they would sell off 49% to Island Def Jam for a year or 2 years or whatever it might be. And then they sold it off to Atlantic? And Warner, they did the same. Yeah. So Case was constantly just trying to get out there and find partners and get advances from bigger labels. And then he would still maintain 51% control of the label, but he would have the big machine pushing, right? So you'd get with these other guys and be like, hey, man, what's going on? Okay, cool. Okay, we're going to see if we can get your record played or whatnot. And it was never that I'm going to fucking murder somebody if I don't get your record played attitude anymore. Yeah.
We don't condone murder at all.
We don't condone murder. Unless it's to get our music played on the radio.
But it was a different culture. It was a very different culture. It went from the fighter culture to, you know, dudes with expensive haircuts and shoes that cost more than, you know, our gear. You know, and so it was really just, you could see these different cultures. Yeah. These, you know, the difference between Roadrunner and Warner, Big, big difference.
Yo, I was just kidding. No. I'm not gonna say it. I won't say it.
Don't say it.
I was drunk this one time, and this one guy from this lady showed up.
Don't even say that. Come on. Let's just next question.
All right.
Anyway, so
seriously,
you're releasing a new record now, and tell me all about it.
Where to begin?
Yeah,
where to begin?
What was the plan for this record? You know,
we can start there.
We the very first song we started working on was "Feed the Machine," we just kind of scratched out this really rough idea of what it would sound like. I mean, now the way we do things is our producer usually puts down fake drums. So you would just use fake drums to play along to, and we all just kind of scratched something out really quickly, and the three of us went over the lyrics and stuff, and we just had this really rough idea, and I don't think any of us were that blown away by it. We left and we were like, it's okay, it's an album cut. But then I kept going back and listening to it, and I was like, this thing's catchy. Like when the chorus would come in every single time, I was like, this is catchy. There's some really cool parts here. And we didn't have a pre-chorus yet either.
But we didn't have a pre-chorus, but that's funny, that chord in the pre-chorus, I was like, I like this. It's not metal at that point, or not like really heavy, but it was something interesting about it, and then ramped up. When he came up with the chorus.
Very un-Nickelback.
Yeah, that's what hooked me at that
point. And that's what we all really loved about it.
Yeah.
But still, you know, there's always something heavy about Nickelback, you know? I think you combine it very well, you know, with the awesome chorus and still the heaviness, you know, and the riffs.
I really, really like you.
That's very kind.
But
thank you.
Yeah, in terms of the writing process and stuff like that, who makes? Does anyone has the final decision, or is it all
together? No. It's always you know, I brought in Hero to these guys.
Yeah.
At the same time, we were making Silver Side Up.
Yeah.
And they were both, for whatever reason, they're like, good song. It just doesn't feel like Nickelback. And in my mind, I was like, are you fucked? I was seriously, in my head, I was just like, this is a good song. Like, but they both, Mike and Ryan, were like, yeah, it's okay.
It was a terrible mistake.
I don't think so. I think it was what it was. And then it fit really well with the Spider-Man thing. But there's no... Like, I certainly wasn't going to sit there and say, nope, this is a good song and it's going on the record and you guys have to listen to me. Because we all, one, we love each other and we respect each other's opinion. And if one person's like, no, I don't think this is a good idea, I think we should, then we respect each other.
Yeah.
If you don't respect everyone's opinion, I just don't think you're going to last long. You know, we care about each other. We're a family. As much as we all have families, we've been in this unit for 20 years. I love you guys! and it's, you know, it's a great family. I've seen dysfunctional musical families, and it's awful.
Yeah.
It's like, you can tell when the singer and the guitar player or somebody, like the two sort of head... People are the sort of like the two main writers or whatever it is. They don't like each other, and it's like, ooh, that's gross. You know, you kind of, you know, they don't want to stand next to each other. They don't want to hang out next to each other, and they just, I can't imagine. I mean, we've all been in relationships where they start to go south.
Yeah.
And you're like, I need to get out of this immediately. Fuck, I need to get out of this. I can't imagine being stuck in that situation. That would be terrible.
Is that something that you talk about in the band?
No, they talk about it behind my back.
Is that an important aspect, you know, in the writing process that you, like, try to involve everybody?
To whatever degree everybody wants to be involved.
Yeah.
Right?
There's no off limits to anything. So when it comes to the lyrics that I have to sing, at no point in time do I say, hey, hey, guys, this is so personal to me that I need to write these. Because we all know each other's history. We all share the same history. So anything I write, they either know exactly what I'm talking about, who I'm talking about, when I'm talking about. And so the way we do it is, there's a big screen TV, and it sits up in the corner at all times, and all the lyrics of the song that we're working on are sitting there. So everybody contribute at any time. So when someone walks in and just goes, oh, and they come up with a line, and you know it's good, then you immediately go over and write it down. It's like, oh, that's really good. That's juicy.
And I think it's got to be like, it's become very to the point where, you know, it's a real vulnerable room.
Yeah.
When you're trying to bring ideas that are personal or whatever it is, and to be able to say, you know, which is just as important, that's good. Hey, validate, that's good, or I don't like that, or for some reason I don't like this, then that's something that's like, that's big for us.
I think
to be able to say that and be okay, where you're not trying to stick a knife in someone's heart, necessarily. We all know how we can say that to each other, where we're like, you know, I'm comfortable with this, I'm not comfortable with this, this is great, this is not, like, I think everybody can kind of understand, we know each other well enough.
So. I think when it comes to lyrics and stuff like that, the more personal and the more just sort of depth it has to it. So you can be poetic, and poetic's always good, but when you know something means something, like has a deep personal meaning to it, that's always way better. Even to the point of just, you know, like just taking your heart right out and being like, and that's what it looked like that day. That's what I felt like that day when that happened. Everyone's always like, ooh, that's good. You know, because you can sit there and be like, you can talk about the moon and the oceans and the mountains and everything else and make, you know, the best metaphors, similes and double entendres and everything else in the universe. Onomatopoeias. but that really deep personal lyric, that's the one that always wins, you know. And these guys know if I'm working on something, you'd be like, good, eh. Like, you can just see it. You can just be like,
what?
No, it's like, not bad, good, not bad. This line has to go. and we that's how we are, you know. Because better is always better. And we want the music to be the best it can be, you know. And if it means, if we sit back and listen to it, and it's like, yes, and you're proud of every single moment of the music, and you're proud of every single lyric, that's when you know you're done.
I always pick one song of an album that I really like, and The Betrayal, Act 3, that's some song, I don't know, it just hit me like a fist, you know. Tell me all about that song.
Ryan said to Daniel, hey, while Chad's in the studio right now working on the lyrics of this song, can you send me like a couple different odd time signature, so it's in 3/4. So he would send drums and all these different things, then Ryan would just work on this guitar riff for like a week. He was recording all these different parts, and then he brought it in and we all listened to it, like just that, and I was like, now I gotta sing in 3/4. What the fuck. But it was good. It was really good, and it had this thing to it. And so when it was sitting there, I was like, okay, he's put a lot of time into this, and it would be easy for me to go, it's okay. We've got all this other stuff we need to work on. Let's work on that first. But it was good, and he had put a ton of work into it. So I was like, okay, if he's going to put that much effort in, I could probably put in a little effort myself. And one day when the boys had left, we cranked it up really loud, and it was just Chris, Baseford, and I. And I started screaming all this different stuff in the chorus. And as soon as I said, you just betrayed, there's just stuff coming out of my mouth, and I'm just, why you just betrayed? And that came out, and then Chris turned around and was like, oh, he's like, that was good, let's get that again. Sing that a few more times, and we'd sing all this stuff. And then it was like, okay, betrayed. I'm betrayed. Like, betrayed. So what was the, what would be like the worst betrayal ever? And I'm like, oh, that one's easy. And then once we did that, then I started, we started doing homework and watching documentaries on it and going through this whole thing and how, you know, theologians have gone through that aspect of everything that had to do with Judas and Jesus, and I had to try to extrapolate some lyrics that weren't completely that,
yeah,
mostly that,
yeah,
but could also be interpreted in another way. I think the 30 pieces gives it away though. But then he came in the next day, and he heard the chorus, and he was like, oh, that's good. I was like, okay, everyone likes this? And he's like, yeah, that's good. And I said, okay, let's start moving forward with this. And then we all sat down and started working on lyrics and stuff, and away we went. And by the time it was done, then he brought in this this little guitar part. And right off the bat, I was kind of like, eh, it's all right.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't fit the theme at all. And I was kind of like, it feels like that, like a Metallica sort of thing, like a definite, like, medieval.
Yeah.
And then the more I thought about it, I'm like, wait, isn't that exactly what this song needs? I'm like, it's actually really smart. And then I said, then I was like, okay, if we're going to do it, let's really do it.
Yeah.
So then, what's that?
Thank you.
No, I thought it really sucked, but then it turned out, it wasn't too bad.
I thought it didn't fit. I never thought it wasn't good. I was just like, it just doesn't fit. And then the more I thought about it, I was like, well, wait, hold on. What if we, like, put in everything and the strings start coming up and more layers and the Ebo part that sounds like a flute comes in and builds and builds and builds.
Yeah.
It has that medieval thing going on to it, which is perfect for the song. And then we were in LA, and then he disappeared for like a week because everyone just came and stayed at my house in LA while we were writing the record, because we recorded everything in Vancouver for tax purposes. And then he brought in like this extended version of the whole thing, and we were all just like, how much weed have you been smoking in your fucking bedroom?
I went in the bedroom and I wrote it in an hour and a half, the part one.
Yeah.
All these parts. And then I waited, funny enough, I waited, because it wasn't, we had these guitars come in from Sweden, funny enough. We sent our guitars away to get these interesting fretboards done on them by, I think it's called
True Temperament. Yeah.
And so they came in on a Wednesday morning, and it was right before we had to leave, like a couple days before. And they came in the morning. And I wanted to get it, at least try to get it down, so it sounded like this idea. And it was like 10 in the morning. You were sleeping. So I'm like, we're doing all this other stuff during the whole day.
That's what I'd be doing at 10 in the morning.
No, I know. But that's what my... Sleeping. So... As we're doing working on, we had so much work left to do on the album, so we were reserving most of the day for that. So I'm like, morning, perfect time. Let's get in. Let's just do this. Engineer gets up early, so we recorded that in about 2 hours. So all the parts just, and it sounds like, but I had done the writing a couple days before that, so we just kind of went boom 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 boom, and I'm like I don't even know if this is going to be anything. It was more like, if we don't have a last song. We could use this as a last song. And it's just interesting. It came out all right. And I just thought that beginning part, there's more to that. I thought we could do something more with this. Yeah. It turned out to be very interesting. When he put the Ebo part on it, it really, for me...
That's when, like, it got really good.
I I really started to enjoy it more. And funny enough, we called it Act One.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, people are asking questions. Where's Act Two?
Everybody wants to know where's that.
That's really and that, because I like the act, and I saw act one, I listened to that, and I was, oh, wait, I'm missing something.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
nobody asks about act four. That can't happen. Yeah, act four can't happen.
Absolutely. So I thought act three.
The number of the counting shall be three.
Act three is the.
Thou shalt not count to two unless proceeding on to three. Four is right out.
Act three was the action. Act one is the calm before the action. Mm-hmm. And I like the fact that it was put to the end of the album like a finishing thing, because I liked hearing it first, a bit of it at the beginning of The Betrayal, part three. And then you hear it at the end. They were like, well, you should ram it up in front of it and just kind of roll right into it. I'm like, no. I like that you hear it later, and it's a touchstone back to that. And it just you just let it out, let it go that way. And then you wonder what happens in the middle. Well, there's a big story in the middle.
Yeah.
Obviously, story out there. So
I'm gonna try to wrap this up.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, I'm. We're too rambling. We're too loquacious.
But let's not forget that other thing that you came up with that was like with the when we restrung that guitar with the Nashville tuning and you went in and did that alternating picking part.
Oh yeah.
We still have that for the next record.
Oh yeah.
Could be act two.
Could be act two.
I'm gonna tell you what I like about that song, and I think it's what Nickelback does best is with that low tuning and good melody on top of that, and combining those two, you know. I don't know how you do it, but do it more.
Thank you. How you do it, but do
thank
it more.
You. Thank you.
Oh, it sounds really good, yeah.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
It's great. Thank you.
But some serious questions here, okay? Who would you like to punch in the face and get away with it?
You know what? I got an answer to this one, and it's I realized that I just moved to Los Angeles, and I was in a situation in my car, and I thought, the next time I get asked, who would you like to physically assault? I got the answer for you. When you're in a parking lot going to park your car, and you're looking for a space and there's no spaces except for one space, but there's a car in it, but the car is just sitting there in reverse, and the reverse lights are on, and you wait,
that
and you wait.
Guy.
Wait,
fucking
wait.
Guy!
Oh, it gets worse. So you sit there, and you're like, okay, motherfucker, back up, you know? And they don't. They just fucking sit there with the reverse lights on. Hey, whatever. No, I'm not done yet. I'm not done yet.
That's it. Hi, I'm right here.
So you wait, and you think, the person just forgot to take the car out of reverse, right? So you start to pull past them, and as soon as you pass them, they back out.
Yeah.
I want to attack that person.
Yeah.
That's good.
You know what?
It's the little things. You
not very many. Not very many things really piss me off, but that's one that pisses me off.
I hate the people that when you're gonna pay for your groceries, and they sorry, I forgot something. I have to run in the store.
Oh shit! That's
for 5 minutes.
Oh, that's me. Yeah. That's me. I do that.
Okay, so everybody's gonna get punched. It's a big circle of punching. Everybody's guilty.
I'll admit that I've done that one before.
If you get to have superpowers for one day, what would it be?
Superpowers for one day.
Like Superman or something like that.
Oh, that's a...
good question.
So which power would it be and what would
anyone who picks invisibility, we all know why you're
picking invisibility. We all know why, exactly.
Shady bastards.
Yeah,
you little pervert.
The shady bastards.
That's a good question. I don't know.
It would be cool to be able to know when people are lying to you.
Yeah, that is cool.
Right away. That would be really good.
I have a pretty good idea anyway.
Yeah. You do.
Do I have a superpower?
But sometimes you're guessing a little. If you could just know.
But how would
I would like to be able to have the power to lie without anybody telling that I'm lying. Right, my friend?
Well, I'm glad these guys don't have
my friend,
that because this whole interview is
my good
bullshit.
Friend.
My lying sense is going.
See,
wrong.
You like that? It's about time.
Come on, stop working.
We've been talking for
I'm
so long.
With, I gotta have something that lasts longer than a day. So I'm gonna say my superpower would be being my own genie and granting myself three wishes.
But you have to wear the suit.
I don't care what suit it is because I get three wishes. You guys get one.
No shirt.
I would make
no shirt. No shirt. Dress for pants, and you gotta be cross-legged the whole time.
There's something about flying.
That's worth
would be
it.
Good. Walking through walls. All that.
I mean, got friends.
You'd have to get all the stupid stuff out of the way. Because if I was a superhero, and it, as stupid as it sounds, I actually thought about this yesterday, and I immediately thought about Hancock.
Yeah.
And the way he kind of does it, he's like, he's just insanely drunk. I mean, I would go through,
apropos,
if I was a superhero, I would have to get that version out of the way, and then you have to start doing good.
But you guys have superheroes here that are like that, right? These guys, the Dudesons, they can fly, they can go through walls. No problem.
They can't keep all their fingers.
Yeah, but they still go through the walls. I mean, you know, it does happen. They're really good at it.
I haven't heard that in a long time.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Are they still around?
I think so.
Are they all still alive?
They haven't made the news yet in that
they're
way.
So hard to find, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you were to live in a TV series, which one?
Live in a TV series?
Yeah. Be in one.
Charlie's Angels.
Sorry. Oh.
Charlie's Angels.
That was fast.
And we all know why.
Came to me quick. Yeah.
That's a good one.
That's a good question. TV series.
Gilligan's Island. Am I going way back? Am I going way back?
There's only, you get Marianne and who's the other one?
Yeah, but I could out-wrestle Gilligan and the professor.
And the Skipper,
I could out-fool him. He's too slow.
Marianne and...
Do you watch Gilligan's Island over here?
That's what I was gonna, I'm trying to stay in. They don't know.
It's like an old 60s one.
Ginger, thank you.
Ginger.
I was thinking of a Love Boat.
That's essentially, yeah, I think it's the same guy.
It's kind of the same thing.
Yeah. I can't, yeah. I don't watch.
Aaron Spelling?
Well, you could say, oh, Breaking Bad, no thank you. Game of Thrones, absolutely no.
No way.
Walking Dead?
Walking Dead. Pass. I don't know anything else that you want. Something funny.
The good ones never end well for the characters, so I don't know.
Arrested Development. Like,
yeah, that's a fun one.
I'll be like one of the stepchildren of the Bluths. Something ridiculous like that.
Well, I know you have a lot to do today, so I'm gonna thank you now,
gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you so much for taking time. And we're looking forward to the album.
I heard it.
Thanks, man. Our listeners looking for it.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very cool.